Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll learn more about how economic development is often based on the racial makeup of a certain area and what the data shows. Illinois has a new law prohibiting police from lying to juveniles in an attempt to get a criminal confession. Why the change had bipartisan support. Also, we'll recall a protest 30 years ago in the Shawnee National Forest to prevent trees from being removed. A documentary tells the story. And in Chicago, some neighborhoods are dealing with a nasty problem. Leaky garbage trucks. They leave behind a smelly, ugly mess.
Yellow, sort of wet sewage.
It's like a white, yellowish kind of vomit color, I guess.
Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about some species that had been in Illinois but recently were declared extinct. We'll also remember a protest at the Shawnee National Forest 30 years ago. And leaky garbage trucks. They're creating a smelly problem for some residents. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. Well, Chicago's population grew slightly over the last decade, according to census figures, but a closer look shows that growth has been uneven. Most of the growth was on the north side or near downtown in majority white neighborhoods, and that has also brought economic development and jobs. In majority black communities, the opposite is true. Esther Yunji Kang of WBEZ examines what's behind the disparity.
I'm standing here on the corner of Randolph and Ogden on Chicago's Near West Side. I look up and there's a 20-plus story building going up here. Just across the street, more construction on a new parking garage. As I head east, I pass by a lot of people walking and talking into their earpieces. Plenty of joggers, toddlers from three different daycares walking at a snail's pace with their teachers. Just outside a swanky bakery in what's known as Chicago's Restaurant Row, I meet Sari Schwartz. She's originally from the suburbs, but moved into the city after 6 years in California.
I just felt like when I moved out to Chicago, I just wanted something a little different, and I felt like West Loop was kind of an up-and-coming new neighborhood, so I thought it'd be cool.
Atop her list of what she wanted in a neighborhood?
Just looking for an area with more restaurants, retail shops, coffee shops, places like that.
And the Near West Side has plenty of that. The next day, I'm a couple of miles over, east and south, in the Near South Side. It's much quieter than the Near West Side, but there are plenty of people pushing strollers and walking their dogs. I meet Tony Chan outside the high-rise building where he and his wife have lived for the past 5 years. He says they love the Near South Side.
We're by the lake. We're 10, 15-minute walk away. There's a lot of green space. We're close to downtown. It almost feels like we're in the middle of the city. We're intersected by all the major highways, 55, 290, 994, and so on.
Chan grew up in Bridgeport, near Chinatown, and had his eye on the Near South Side.
I've seen this area just explode in terms of development and people living here and people moving here.
He's right. The area where he lives is booming, much like the Near West Side. In fact, a look at new 2020 census data shows these two neighborhoods, along with a handful of others mostly on the north side, accounted for nearly all the population growth in Chicago since 2010. WBEZ crunched some numbers and found that it's these areas where people, namely white residents, some Asians, are flocking to. The opposite is true for most majority black neighborhoods. We also looked at other growth markers, jobs, new construction, new businesses. And we found that majority white communities collectively experienced the highest growth in all three, while black communities saw the least growth.
Real estate investment is about return on investment.
That's Mike Moravec. He's with the John Buck Company, a real estate investment and development firm.
The investors are looking for a return on their investment, and a growth area represents a positive situation where that return is more likely. To acquire a site where there is no growth is not worth the investment. And so, you know, people don't, or investors don't want to go there.
One big area the firm's invested in recently is the Near West Side. Moravec says for developers to go to the city's majority black neighborhoods, there need to be public-private partnerships. I ask him what that would look like.
You know, I don't have all the answers to this very difficult challenge. You know, perhaps there's some land that the city could contribute at a very low cost basis, perhaps.
Like developers, businesses too are looking for a return on investment. A few months ago, I was on the Near West Side for the opening of Dispensary 33, a medical and recreational cannabis shop. An employee showed me around the beautiful industrial space with wood beam ceilings and display cases of neatly arranged weed products.
So these are all of our edible tables, and they're organized by type. So we have chocolates over here, gummies.
I met Paul Lee, one of the owners of the dispensary, which opened its first location in Andersonville on the north side in 2015. When Lee and his partners were looking to open their second shop, the Near West Side was a no-brainer.
This is just a nicer area where they've done a lot of construction, business building, and it's now an area where it's desirable to live.
Business owners, developers, and residents all want the same stuff: convenience, amenities, retail, and restaurants. No one I spoke to mentioned race explicitly, but some say it's inextricable from all the other factors.
Race is a big factor in the growth and development and revitalization in Chicago communities. It's a big factor that many people do not want to acknowledge.
That's urban planner Pete Saunders. He says race affects all the building blocks that make up growth: the institutions, the businesses, the people. And each of them are making choices that are leaving black communities in the lurch.
There is a resistance to investing in black neighborhoods that's passed on from generation to generation. It lives on beyond the old redlining days from the 1930s and forward.
Jacqueline Huang teaches sociology at Stanford University. She studies how neighborhoods change in U.S. cities and how that's related to racial segregation. She says the lens through which people see neighborhoods matters.
We know from research on neighborhood preferences that there's a lot of bias in how people view neighborhoods, and discrimination in preferences as well, especially in a city like Chicago, which is hyper-segregated.
Huang says in a capitalist society, it only makes sense that developers, investors, and businesses will build and set up shop where they expect to see profit. So who bears the responsibility for inequitable growth?
I think it's really on policymakers to promote investment in other places, create more equitable growth, equal quality of life across neighborhoods.
Huang says having strong policies that keep housing affordable and allowing for participatory planning of neighborhoods will lead to more equitable growth. Nidra Sims Fears heads the Greater Chatham Initiative, which promotes economic growth in Chatham and other majority black Southside neighborhoods. Those areas have not seen the same boom as their North and Northwest Side counterparts. Sims Fears has some words for developers and businesses relying on incentives from the city to bring construction and jobs to black neighborhoods.
They need to get off the city of Chicago welfare. It just blows my mind that we have to pay them to come to our community. Either they want us as customers or they don't.
She says it's a vicious cycle. The private sector doesn't invest in black neighborhoods, and so black residents leave the city. Developers and businesses then neglect the neighborhoods that are left behind, and so on and so forth.
Don't tell me about loss in population when I can't give people how they want to live because you won't build the housing in our community. So you just talk in circles.
Still, Sims Fears is hopeful. She thinks the conversations on race and equity spurred in recent years will lead to change. She hopes all of Chicago, not just its white neighborhoods and the areas near downtown, will grow and thrive in coming years. Esther Yunji Kang, WBEZ News.
Illinois has become the first state to bar police from lying to children under 18 during interrogations. That practice has led to false confessions. Patrick Smith tells us more.
To understand the motivation behind this bill and how it won almost unanimous support in a divided Illinois legislature, it helps to know the story of the Inglewood Four. It was March of 1995. Chicago police hauled in four black teenagers from the Chicago neighborhood of Inglewood and accused them of the rape and murder of Nina Glover.
I was sat down and they cuffed me to the chair and they were, you know, started asking me questions about this rape and murder. And I'm, whoa, what? Excuse me?
That's Terrell Swift, one of the teens picked up by police. He told them he didn't even know what they were talking about. They didn't believe him.
Oh, you know what you guys did? You guys raped and murdered this woman. And, you know, he was like, hey, you're going to die in jail. You're never going home. My life is, you know, flashing before me, sitting there like, how am I going to die in jail? I don't even know what's going on.
After hours of that, Swift says he started to believe them.
I've never been to jail. I don't know how jail works. You're telling me I'm never going to see my family again. I don't know if that's true. You know, I don't know.
As Swift sat with his life flashing before him, an officer walked in and said, hey, I know you didn't do this, but the other kids say you did. So I need you to cooperate. Admit you were there and you can go home. So we cooperated. Ultimately, all four teenagers confessed to a brutal rape and murder they did not commit. DNA evidence exonerated them almost 20 years later. Now, this new legislation would bar officers from deceiving young people in the way Chicago detectives deceive Swift and his co-defendants. Under the bill, if police lie to a juvenile during an interrogation about the facts of the case, like telling them a witness saw you do this, or if they lie about the consequences of confessing, telling them just say you did it and you get to go home, the juvenile's confession will be thrown out. The legislation has the support of law enforcement and prosecutor groups in the state. Republican Illinois State Representative Jim Durkin is also a former prosecutor.
I am not soft on crime, but I'm harder on reaching the truth. Yes, juveniles do commit crimes, and juveniles will be held accountable for their crimes, but they also can be manipulated. It's the classic situation, just tell me what happened, tell me the truth, and I'll make sure you can go home.
Young people under age 18 are about 2 to 3 times more likely than adults to confess to crimes that they didn't commit.
That's Laura Nyrider, co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University.
What we've come to understand is that police lies about the evidence and police lies about the consequences of confessing can cause innocent people to believe it's actually in their interest to falsely confess.
And that's exactly what happened to Terrell Swift. Police lied and told him all the other kids said he had done it. They told him if he said what they told him to say and signed the confession, he could go home to his mom and dad.
I mean, 17. I mean, again, like you think you're grown, but you're not, you know, and you also, you think the police are going to help you. And especially when you didn't do anything. So it's like, okay, yeah. What do you need me to do? Yeah, I'll help. Helping led to me being convicted and losing 15 and a half years of my life.
The deception police used in their interrogations of the Inglewood Four stole years from the lives of innocent young men. It also ended up costing taxpayers more than $60 million in legal payouts. Wrongful conviction payouts have become increasingly common in the state. On top of that, the DNA evidence that exonerated Swift and his co-defendants, it actually pointed to another man, a serial rapist. Evidence suggests he went on to rape and kill again. Illinois State Representative Justin Slaughter says that's another consequence of police lying to juveniles.
Sometimes people forget when you have incarcerated the wrong individual, the actual offender is still out in the community. And all too often what we've seen is these offenders go on to commit further crimes.
Slaughter and others hope the bill he helped craft will serve as a model. And there are already similar bills being considered by state lawmakers in New York and Oregon. I'm Patrick Smith in Chicago.
Wineries and breweries have become more common in Illinois. So have distilleries. Peoria was once known as Whiskey City because so much was made there. While not quite on the same scale, some are still keeping that tradition alive. Tim Shelley spoke with a master distiller, Jeff Murphy, of J.K. Williams in Peoria.
When it comes to what makes a good whiskey or what makes a good bourbon, let's just talk whiskey in general. I think that there's a lot of things that you can change up to change your flavors around. I look at it from a brewing standpoint or craft brewing standpoint where you have, you know, 100 different types of grain or more that you could use as your bases or as supplements to your base malts, you know, whether you're using corn as the base or whatnot. You know, you've got rye, wheats, felt, oats. You've got all kinds of different things you can throw in there, and that's just your mash. Then you got to ferment that mash, and your different yeast strains also give you different flavor profiles as well. Each yeast strain is a little bit different, and then all that becomes distiller's beer mash, so to speak, that you go into processing with. It comes down to the distillation as far as if you imagine, you know, people talk about their cuts. If you imagine all your alcohols in there, all those are on a giant sliding scale, so to speak. So depending upon what flavor profile you're looking for, you can slide this way towards the scale, open this side up, and take more hearts, which gives you more flavors on the heads and the tail side. You can squeeze it together and get more something more neutral for a light whiskey if you want. And then you got everything in between. You can slide that around. That's where the art comes in, and that's where distillers differ.
Tell me a little bit about the role that aging and the barrels have in the whiskey making process.
You know, your barrels make a big difference. You have different toast and char levels, and depending upon what you're looking for, it all has to be American oak, white oak for bourbons and straight whiskeys and American straight whiskeys such as rye and stuff. Toast levels, your char levels change your flavor profile. And what happens in the barrel is when you put the whatever proof you decide to go in at, the alcohol goes in, it penetrates that wood, dissolves the compounds that are made during the toasting and charring process. And then basically through osmosis over time, it just kind of pulls everything back in. Now, barrels have cycles, and those are with the seasons too. That's another thing that you can add into it. So in the winter, the barrels kind of tighten up because it's nice and cold, especially up here. And in the summertime when it's nice and hot, the barrels kind of expand a bit and you get a little bit better penetration. So it has this fluctuation on the extremes between winter and summer. And the spring and the fall is when they're kind of mostly at their neutral point. So a lot of places try to harvest in the spring and the fall for their batches. But then the time in the barrel also makes a difference, how long it's in there, the size of the barrel that you're using. There's so many different variables that go into the aging process. And the magic happens in the barrel, the oxidation, all that stuff happens in the barrel.
That's Jeff Murphy, a master distiller in Peoria with J.K. Williams. He spoke about making whiskey, and he talked with Tim Shelley. Well, there's more on the way. When it comes to encouraging the unvaccinated to get the COVID-19 shots, what messaging works best? A survey provides some answers. We'll have more on that next here on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Since COVID-19 vaccines have been made widely available, public health officials have presented different messaging for why Americans should get the shot. And according to new survey research from the Chicago-based company Civis Analytics, messages emphasizing vaccine safety can backfire, leading to greater hesitancy. But campaigns focused on the financial costs of COVID and the need to protect children are most likely to be effective. Those findings based on a survey of more than 5,000 unvaccinated U.S. adults. To learn more, Christine Herman spoke with Crystal Sun. She's a data scientist with Civis Analytics who led the study.
I've heard public health experts say that it's not just what the message is that's important, but also who the messenger is. And I know that that's kind of beyond the scope of this survey research, but how do you imagine that that factors into how these survey results are taken and applied? It's got to be both and, right?
It does, yeah. So ideally, you would have different sets of messengers, and then each of those messengers gives the same set of different messages. So you'd have like the physician deliver the message about financial costs, and then you'd also have an employer deliver the message about financial costs, for instance. It makes for a very complicated experiment and would require a lot of people to participate. What we have done in the past is we've worked with an organization, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, that was really interested in employers and how they should talk to to their employees about getting vaccinated. And we put scripted things in the employer's voice. And we find exactly what you would expect, which is that a message like the vaccine, you know, talking about sort of like the science and the morbidity, mortality due to COVID. So a little bit, you have a little bit more medical text to it, a little bit more scientific jargon. That could be something that is effective if your doctor or somebody who has a scientific background delivers that, but that's not something that employees want to hear from their employers.
Huh. Okay. And so I also understand that your primary audience for this these research findings is like public health officials who are trying to do messaging around the vaccine. But are there lessons to be learned by like everyday people? Like say I have a family member or relative who's still vaccine hesitant. Do you think some of these lessons also apply to those kinds of conversations? And if so, like what would be your advice to someone who's trying to navigate a conversation with a vaccine hesitant friend?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't have the data from our experience. Experiment is definitely set up so that it's most useful for an organization that's talking to a wider audience rather than just like individual one-on-one conversations. But I do think that the themes, which we keep noticing, you know, a couple of themes, generally, repeatedly, we see that being negative in your messaging, so trying to scare people into getting vaccinated because COVID is really scary and it's expensive and dangerous, or guilting people and saying like, do it for your grandmother. Those are not messages that we see to be persuasive, but more importantly, the way we do our testing, we can actually measure if something is less, it is likely to make someone less likely to get vaccinated. We call that negative backlash, which is not something that to date, I have not seen any organizations actually like considering that as a possibility. I think that that could hold very much true for individual conversations as well. I mean, I think it may feel very, you know, like you're taking action and like you're doing something effective to try to guilt someone and make them feel scared. That isn't something that we would recommend.
That's Crystal Sun, data scientist with Civis Analytics, and she spoke with Christine Herman. A cybersecurity expert says COVID-19 has made our workplaces less safe from online threats. Dan Taube is the interim chief information security officer at Illinois State University. He spoke with Eric Stock and says that businesses, schools, banks, and others who had large numbers of people working from home are especially vulnerable.
So it's not only just the devices that they're using may not have the protections installed on the devices, but the detection of an event or an incident that we may see on our own network goes unnoticed. And so maybe they did get malware or a virus on their computer, or their password was compromised because of a phishing attack. Since they're working away from the organization, our tools that monitor the network don't see that activity. And so during the pandemic, the attackers know this and they shifted a little bit to be the volume of attacks increased, as well as the methods that they did to target remote individuals. Now, added to that was they used what we saw in the legitimate space as some of their scams. So they would say, click this or respond to this to get your financial benefits or your unemployment insurance or your you know, sign up early for the vaccine. They use those as well because of the pandemic and were very effective with it.
Did it make us easier targets because of this? In our desperate search sometimes for the right information?
I think so. In research that's been done about why even trained individuals fall for social engineering attacks, it's usually because of distractions or too much going on. And I think with the pandemic and everything else going on in general society, it created a lot of noise that whenever something seemed urgent or important, you just get into the sense of reacting in the moment and you're not doing the checks and balances that you would normally do when everything's calm and comfortable. And I think that's a product of the pandemic and what we've been going through.
Any examples that you can speak to in your work experience where those distractions have built up and have caused someone to take their eye off the ball, so to speak?
Yes, I can share one in particular for myself where I thought about it and considered it and caught myself, but we had a few incidents of security events that required all hands on deck. It's the entire team responding, bringing in other individuals, analyzing a lot of information. And during one of those events in particular, as I'm focused on everything going on, many communication channels, different audiences to speak with, I received a phone call. And that phone call, I associated with the event and being legitimate because they said just the right type of things to get my mind in this distracted state to think it was related. And it was just one thing they said that led me to pause for a moment, ask a question of them, and realize, no, this is unrelated and happened to be someone trying to compromise me individually.
How safe is Illinois State University from being hacked?
That's an interesting question. If you know, someone were to ask if we are secure, I would be hesitant to say yes, but I would assert that we're always working towards being secure. It's a continual effort type of thing. Now, over the past year alone, we've done a lot of projects to specifically address threats that a university or higher education in general faces. We are better now than we've ever been, just out of a sheer need to do it with the pandemic and everyone being away from campus and having less chance to educate them, but also because we see the attempts to compromise us. We experience it every so often that it's more than just phishing. It's someone that's trying to get into our environment, and that will be a constant battle. Now, there's one specific challenge we face as a university, and anyone in education will share this. We can't be too restrictive. We need to enable the core mission of the institution to teach and conduct research and communicate across the board, where we're limited in exactly what we can do.
That's Dan Taube of Illinois State University speaking with Eric Stock. Taube says consumers are generally lax about protecting their online data. He advises not using the same password for multiple accounts and recommends using a password manager that can store them and generate secure passwords. He says scammers have also gotten better at distinguishing phishing attempts to look legitimate. Well, a lifetime fascination has resulted in a new book. Chris Pio is from Galesburg, and he's just published Griffins, Gorlocks, and Gusties, a history of the NCAA Division III nicknames and mascots. Herb Trick spoke with him and has this report.
Chris Pio says his fascination started while he was coaching track and cross country at Monmouth College and working as sports information director in the 1980s and 90s. But the actual serious research in writing didn't happen until 2017, when he was recovering from an injury.
It was just one of those subjects that I was passionate about as a lifelong sports fan. Again, as a coach with 20-plus years on the college level, sports information work, I've always been fascinated by sports history and trivia, facts and figures, and it was just something that I was interested in. I didn't know if there was anybody out there that cared about it as much as I did, but it was just something personally fascinating. I thought it was something that a Division III audience would be receptive to, whether they were student athletes, whether they were coaches, administrators, alumni. I just thought it was a story worth telling.
His book includes 450 stories, 439 currently active D3 schools, and 11 more that have either closed or consolidated since he began writing. He looked at college websites, internet sources, and previous publications.
You would think if it was an animal, if it was an eagle or a hawk or a lion or a tiger, it would just be because of the animal and the characteristics. But oftentimes there were really uncommon backstories.
And one of his favorites is the jumbos.
The best animal example that I can use that comes to mind is an elephant. The jumbos of Tufts University out in Medford, Massachusetts, they are the jumbos because one of the original trustees of the university was P.T. Barnum. And B.T. Barnum had the show animal, the prized elephant, Jumbo. So Jumbo not only became the mascot and the nickname of Tufts University, but it became a word in the English language that had never existed before.
He chose the three names in the title of his book because they're unique among small colleges in the U.S. and for the alliteration, Griffins, Gorlocks, and Gusties.
Griffin is a mythological character. It's a creature with the
head and the wings of an eagle, and the feet and the body of a lion. So the griffin embodies the king of the sky and the king of the land. So it had some legendary properties. It's always seen as the guardian of treasure. Gorlok was a fictional creature that was made up by the student body of Webster University in St. Louis. Webster is located in Webster Groves, which is a suburb of St. Louis, and two streets that intersect near the heart of the campus, Gore Avenue and Lockwood Avenue, Gorlok. It's a compound word that they just made up because of the street intersection. They created this fictional creature that, just like the griffin, is a combination of animals. It's part cheetah, part buffalo, part St. Bernard.
And Gustes comes from the name of Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. Many names come from the founders of each college, whether it be Vikings, Fighting Scots, or the Norse.
There are 17 schools that have some version of Hawks as their nickname: Warhawks, Riverhawks, Dewhawks, Cohawks. But the reason why they are called that is not the same from one school to the next. So it's been really fascinating to find out the subtle differences, because a lot of it ties back into the school's history or some event. It's as much a sports book as it is a history book, and I hope people enjoy reading it as much as I did writing it.
Next Pile plans to write a similar book about Division II colleges and their nicknames, and then go on to Division I. I'm Herb Trix.
There's a smelly problem in some Chicago neighborhoods, what's been called garbage juice. It's not a rock band. It's how one alderman describes the leaky trail some garbage trucks leave behind, and residents describe the odor as worse than sewage. Mariah Wolfel sniffed out the story.
This morning, I visited the alley of Sophie Leroy and Scott Ellingson's Albany Park apartment on the northwest side. Garbage collectors had just passed through, and we know this not because of the freshly emptied trash cans, but because of the puddles of goo that now line the alley.
It's a mixture of like motor oil, yellow, sort of wet sewage.
It's like a white, yellowish kind of vomit color, I guess.
Accurate. And it smells like all of those things. Maybe add in rotten milk, all mixed together.
We found that wearing masks helps, which is very common.
Oh, man, it does smell, though.
Ellingson and Leroy, who've lived in Albany Park for a couple of years now, started noticing the smell last summer, and they soon got in touch with their alderman, Carlos Ramirez Rosa.
And, you know, we're used to complaints about rats, tree trims. Those are things that we regularly receive. But about 2 months ago, my ward superintendent started to tell me that residents were complaining about garbage juice leaking from the trucks.
Ramirez Rosa says he and his ward superintendent, the person employed by the Department of Streets and Sanitation to work on street level issues in wards, were told it was a pandemic related supply chain issue. Trucks that would normally receive regular maintenance, he says, weren't able to get specific parts replaced, causing the trucks to leak. Ramirez Rosa says he wasn't completely satisfied with the answer.
I still felt that it was important to bring this up during budget committee hearings to hear directly from the commissioner on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Acting Commissioner. I, too, am excited.
Enter a particularly trashy conversation in the middle of the city council's ongoing annual budget process, where aldermen get to question the head of each department on anything from staff-level funding to garbage goo.
I have a number of questions today. The first one is related to leaky garbage trucks. They're complaining about a record amount of garbage juice just spilling out.
Acting Streets and Sanitation Commissioner Cole Stollard says the leak stems from a broken but seemingly crucial piece of the garbage truck apparatus.
It's a plug, and if it rains and the garbage is soaking wet, that plug in the bottom of what we call the hopper that takes the what we call the juice, it sits in that hopper, and if that plug comes out, that's what causes the stream down the alley, and it does smell.
Stollard nor the Department of Streets and Sanitation mentioned the supply chain issue Ramirez Rosa was informed about. The department simply told aldermen to report specific fleets that are causing the issue so that they can get repaired. Ramirez Rosa says he wants a longer-term solution, whether that's more funding to replace aging trucks or more frequent stops to empty the trucks more often. In the meantime, Northwest Side residents dealing with the issue are just avoiding their alleys altogether. And fun garbage puns aside, Michael Wachter says for him, it's a serious concern.
So with the garbage trucks going through and dropping this horrible toxic sludge onto the pavements, people get it on their car tires and they drag it into their garage. They, you know, you see footprints going through it because people aren't expecting it and they walk through it, you know, and it just sits there and festers.
The city did not provide information on how widespread the issue is, but says it does have the funding to fix trucks once they're reported.
That's Mariah Wolfel with that report. You're listening to Statewide. There is more ahead. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, a new film chronicles a protest at the Shawnee National Forest 30 years ago. We'll have that story. Well, growing peas and beans is gaining traction in the Midwest as demand increases for the products and the conservation benefits become more clear. Elizabeth Rimbert reports on what's driving the push and the pros and cons of growing peas and beans.
When you walk down a grocery store aisle, you probably don't take a second look at bags of lentils or canned chickpeas. But with a closer eye, you might be surprised at where else you can find beans and peas on the shelves.
And we also have things like, okay, pea toast, which are like Cheetos made from peas. Their tagline is junk food taste made from peas.
And in the freezer aisle.
So here is, here we have the Beyond ground beef, quote unquote. Ingredients, water, pea protein.
The latest data from the United States Department of Agriculture estimates that people are consuming 2 more pounds of legumes per year than they were in 2000. And experts see that climb continuing. Eric Thalkin is one of the farmers growing the main ingredients in those Pitos or Beyond burgers.
A little more than 2,000 acres, 5 miles that way, down to Dorchester. So,
this was peas.
He harvested his peas in July on his organic farm in southeast Nebraska. He chose to plant them because they work well as a third crop in his corn and soybean rotation. Peas fit into his planting and harvest schedule, and they use less water while adding nutrients to the soil as they grow. So pea farmers are able to nourish their fields and collect a paycheck.
It feels like the ground is more energetic after peas. So we've grown like double crop corn, no additional fertilizer, peas. Everything always looks really good after peas.
Falcon is a board member on the state's recently formed Dry Pea and Lentil Commission, which aims to coordinate research, advocacy, and crop insurance for farmers interested in trying out peas. The commission will also help farmers learn to overcome the challenges of growing peas.
There's a couple problems, and one is that it's really hard to harvest. Harvest is very slow and difficult. We might harvest 40 acres a day here, where soybeans we could do 130.
Another obstacle is the unpredictability of pricing. Last year, pea prices fell to their lowest in a decade. This year, they've rallied to near all-time highs in some regions. Roel Rushman, a co-director on the commission, has been growing peas in western Nebraska for about 12 years. He says this momentum for peas in the region matches the global demand for pulse crops.
I think it was bound to happen because of the world outcry for pulses.
Pulse crops is an industry term that describes beans, peas, and lentils. Companies are also betting that the Great Plains will work as a source and logistics center.
And as farmers react to markets, well, then processors see, hey, we can do something in this geography.
One company that's hoping to cash in is Columbia Grain International. The supplier recently bought a plant in Hastings, Nebraska, to clean and prepare peas for sale. Tony Roloffs heads up the Pulse Crops Division for CGI, and he hopes that the plant fills a gap for farmers in the region.
I think that's been the biggest struggle for farmers in the area is they just haven't had a consistent demand or a consistent market for their pulses.
Marvin Fast manages the plant for CGI. He says he was born and raised with corn and soybeans, but working with peas has been a rewarding change.
Actually seeing it in a grocery store, that is really cool to me.
The commission, a dedicated facility, and this year's high prices give advocates hope that Great Plains farmers could start planting more peas and beans. They're confident the demand for pea and bean products will continue to increase, but they also acknowledge the risks of trying something new could dissuade some growers from giving peas a chance. Elizabeth Rembert, Harvest Public Media.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently delisted 23 species, including birds, river mussels, and a flower, from the endangered species list, deeming them extinct. Among those 23, two that used to reside here in Illinois. To learn more, Brian Moline spoke with agriculture and environment reporter Dana Cronin.
I understand one of these species is a bird, a woodpecker to be exact, and the other is a freshwater mussel. Can you give us a little background on them?
Yeah, listeners may have heard of the ivory-billed woodpecker. It's one of the more well-known species that was delisted recently. The ivory-billed lived mostly in the southeast region of the U.S., but it also extended throughout the Mississippi River Basin, up through Illinois and Indiana. They're these big, beautiful birds that actually have been described as the woody woodpecker bird. They have black and white bodies and a bright red sort of crown on their heads. Here's what they used to sound like. The other species that was delisted was the tubercled blossom pearly mussel, quite a name. And to break that name down a bit, these mussels had tubercles, or like little bumps, that ran down the middle of the shell, and then they have a pearly white inside. So if you think about old buttons, like on a vintage shirt, a lot of those buttons were made out of shells from these tubercled blossom pearly mussels. In Illinois, the tubercled blossom was mostly found in the Wabash River, which is the river that divides Indiana and Illinois.
And Dana, I know you talked to a couple of specialty biologists about these now extinct species. Were they able to tell you what caused their population declines here in Illinois?
Yeah, first I should acknowledge that neither the ivory-billed woodpecker nor the tubercled blossom pearly mussel have been spotted alive here in Illinois in at least a century. The last verified sighting of an ivory-billed woodpecker was in 1944. So while it is sad to delist these species, it wasn't exactly surprising to scientists. In terms of what caused their extinctions, the short answer is that we did. If we're talking about the woodpecker, their habitat, which was old-growth bottomland forest ecosystems, has been largely destroyed for things like agriculture and lumber. And the story's not too terribly different with the tubercled blossom pearly mussel. Human-made dams played a huge role in their demise. Here's Allison Stadola, a mollusk expert with the Illinois Natural History Survey.
So freshwater mussels like to live in flowing water because they're sedentary. They don't move very much throughout their lifetime. So they kind of need the water to bring the food to them. So if the water changes from this flowing river ecosystem into a lake, they can no longer survive.
She says a general decline in water quality has also contributed to their extinction, including fertilizer runoff from farms. And with all these factors added together, freshwater mussels are actually one of the most endangered groups of organisms in the U.S.
So now that these species don't exist here anymore, what does that mean for this region and how would that affect Illinois' ecosystems?
Well, when species go extinct, it's obviously not a good sign for the overall ecosystem. Here's Jeff Hoover. He's an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey.
When you lose what might be called an umbrella species, that species that kind of encapsulate old growth, bottomland, hardwood forests, if that thing goes away, then there's a lot of other things that were under that umbrella that are also now going to potentially be in peril.
And, you know, for the tubercled blossom pearly mussel, those are filter feeders. Allison Stadola told me when freshwater mussels go, that's seen as a warning sign to biologists that our rivers are not healthy. And while you can still find fossilized tubercled blossom shells in Illinois riverbeds, it's kind of sad to think we'll never see riverbeds how they used to look. Allison Stadola was telling me there are these descriptions from some early freshwater mussel scientists of riverbeds completely covered in these pearly mussel shells, which sounds pretty amazing. But, you know, Brian, to end on somewhat of a hopeful note, there is a lot we can do to clean up our waterways and prevent even more mussels and birds from meeting the same fate as these two species.
That's my Illinois Newsroom colleague, Dana Cronin. Dana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, a new film by a professor at SIU Carbondale tells the story about an environmental protest that took place in the early 1990s. It led to a temporary ban on harvesting trees from the Shawnee National Forest at a site near Murfreesboro. Kevin Boucher with member station WSIU has more.
The new film is called Shawnee Showdown, Keep the Forest Standing. It's a new documentary from filmmaker Cade Burcell. Bursell is also professor of cinema at the School of Media Arts at SIUC. And using archival footage and new interviews, her new film tells the story of how environmentalists held a nearly 80-day blockade and protest in the summer of 1990 to stop the United States Forest Service from harvesting trees in the Fairview area near the Little Grand Canyon near Murfreesboro in Jackson County. Media coverage at the time showed the passion of the protesters, with photographs of three protesters who had buried themselves up to their waist at the site, and activists who literally chained themselves to heavy equipment, including a bulldozer.
The group of people who are in the film, you know, they protested in the 90s. They lost the battle at six sites. There were six sites that were logged. But they eventually won in court, and that's what's such an interesting story, is that they were successful. They were activists who engaged in direct action, like what you described, chaining themselves, you know, to the trucks and, you know, things like that, the gates. But they also pursued this legal course of action, and eventually a lawyer came on board, Tom Buschel, and he came on. Until then, they had been doing all this research themselves and were going to court pro se, which is really remarkable. They spent a lot of time in legal libraries and, you know, trying to figure out this court system.
And when the activists were not in the library, they were camping out on the Forest Service land, literally blocking the path of the loggers. Jan Wilder was there protesting in 1991 and remembers it vividly.
Yeah, chaining John got chained, and they had to use bolt cutters, I think a welding tool to weld him off of his chains. He did that action on his birthday, so he got arrested on his birthday.
Another tactic was used.
So we staged a hunger strike. So for 3 weeks, I didn't eat food. And then I flew to D.C., while I was on my hunger strike.
In making the film, since Facebook and social media were not available back in the early 1990s, Bursell just couldn't log on to a website and download audio and video to make the film.
That's kind of a funny story, because it turns out that several of the activists had videotaped the news footage off the television. And they produced bags of VHS tapes, and those tapes had mold on them. So I had to try to see the tapes and then figure out which ones I needed to send out to be cleaned. And so some of the footage, when you see the film, you know, the footage has deteriorated, but it is such good footage. And when I had called the news stations, they didn't really have access to this footage any longer. I mean, it's 30 years.
That was my
Or they didn't know where it was. And
sure.
So through fair use, I have, and cleaning this footage, I've been able to save some of this important history. And I'm really happy for that. And then we made DVDs for folks, and when I returned the VHS tapes to them.
Another protester featured in the film is Sam Stearns, who lives near Bellsmith Springs, deep in the Shawnee National Forest in southeastern Illinois. And in this new documentary, Stearns' passion for the forest comes through.
I'm a longtime lover of the Shawnee National Forest.
Last week, I asked Stearns, wasn't he afraid that he would lose his job over protesting the timber harvest in the Shawnee?
Well, the forest was more important to me than my job. At two different places of employment, I had people show up at my job and tried to get me fired based on my forest activism. In both cases, my employers backed me up.
And fellow activist Jan Wilder says as the years have gone by, she has slowed down a bit, but a phone call from filmmaker Cade Bursell lit the fire again.
Cade called me and said, would you like to interview? And she put together this documentary, like a miracle documentary, documenting the history of our struggle to save the Shawnee. When she sent me the first draft. I watched it. My son was here. And it just brought everything back to the forefront of my mind and my heart.
That's Southern Illinois environmental activist Jan Wilder, who was among the protesters in the early 1990s seeking to stop the U.S. Forest Service from cutting down trees in the Fairview area of the Shawnee National Forest near Murfreesboro. Wilder is one of several activists seen in the new documentary film called Shawnee Showdown, Keep the Forest Standing. The film is by Cade Bursell, a professor of cinema at the School of Media Arts at SIU Carbondale. I'm Kevin Boucher.
Well, thanks for being with us on Statewide. And remember, you can always find our episodes at nprillinois.org and through the NPR One app. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.